Morning, church family. Today we're reading from Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 to 20. Sarah lived to be 127 years old. She died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. Then Abraham rose from beside his dead wife and spoke to the Hittites. He said, "I'm a foreigner and stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site here so that I can bury my dead." The Hittites replied to Abraham, "Sir, listen to us. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will refuse you his tomb for burying your dead." Then Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites. He said to them, "If you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf, so that he will sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you." Ephron the Hittite was sitting among his people, and he replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of his city. "No, my lord," he said, "listen to me. I give you the field and I give you the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead." Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in their hearing, "Listen to me. If you will, I will pay the price of the field. Accept it from me so that I can bury my dead there." Ephron answered Abraham, "Listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. But what is that between you and me? Bury your dead." Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current among the merchants. So Ephron's field in Machpelah, near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the borders of the field, was legally made over to Abraham as his property, in the presence of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of the city. Afterwards, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which is at Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave in it were legally made over to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site. Our next reading is Hebrews chapter 11. We'll be reading from verses 8 to 10, and then from verses 13 to 16. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in a promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. This is the word of the Lord.
And a very warm welcome if you've arrived since we've begun. It's really great to have you here. I'm Johnny, the assistant minister, and if I haven't yet met you, I'd love to meet you afterwards. Do hang around. I'd love you to tear off a bit of your service sheet and keep it in Hebrews 11 as a bookmark, but then turn back to Genesis 23. Okay, we're going to be mostly in Genesis 23, but we will turn on to Hebrews 11 again later. Let's multitask. While you do that, I'm going to pray. Lord, we just sang, let your word cause hearts to awaken. Lead all your children to pour out your praises. Well, that is our desire as we go out into the world. We want other people's hearts to awaken and come to you. But first, we need our own hearts to reawaken. So would you speak to us again now? Speak to our hearts and transform us to go out into the world as you will. In Jesus' name, amen. Great. So Genesis 23, are we back there? We've been going through this Abraham story, haven't we? And let's carry on with this next section. There's no place like home. Maybe like me, it's a long time since you've watched The Wizard of Oz. But even if you've forgotten most of the plot, That's the key line, isn't it? That's the famous line, the most famous line of the film. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. The issue really underneath the film and the whole plot is that, isn't it? It's homesickness. Homesickness. We all need a place to call home. And for Dorothy, there's her, you know, very ordinary, boring Kansas life that she wants to leave behind. There's the much more exciting Technicolor Land of Oz. More exciting, but a bit more dangerous as well. It raises the question, doesn't it? Where is her home? What is a home? What is a home? I wonder, would you call your flat or your house a home? Or is it just a place you go to bed, wake up, make breakfast, go to work, come back, go to bed, make your breakfast, go to work? Is it a home for you? Some of us might think of where we were born or maybe where we grew up as home. We talk about going back home. What is it about that place that makes it home? For some of us, it might actually be maybe more a social group, a group of people that's where we feel most at home when we're with them. We all need a place to call home. That's, of course, why homelessness is such a horrible or frightening thing. But here's the issue. Even if we do have a roof over our heads physically, do we really have a home? One of the most thoughtful voices on this kind of theme, I think, is Wendell Berry. I don't know if you've come across him, American poet and writer. He did an interview with The New Yorker a few years ago, and he describes how he used to live in New York for a while. He's from rural Kentucky, but he moved to New York and he was writing, meeting all these writers, kind of learning his trade. His career was blossoming, looking very promising, but he felt an irresistible urge to go back home to rural Kentucky. And all his new kind of writer colleagues thought it was completely bonkers, thought he was throwing his career away. What are you doing going back there? He shares in this interview how they said that he was putting himself under the influence of the village virus. Do you know that idea? That, you know, you go back somewhere rural like that, the back of beyond, and everyone there is, you know, narrow-minded and backwards and probably racist and sexist and stupid. It's this kind of stereotype, isn't it, of the country bumpkin out in the provinces. But he hasn't become like that. He's actually maintained a beautiful, serene contentment, kindness, thoughtfulness, wisdom, as his 80 books testify. And I think we get a bit of that same stereotype here in London, don't we? You know, the cities, London particularly, that's where it's at. You know, there's this irresistible, unstoppable urbanization, and kind of this is where the action is really, isn't it? And if you haven't got here yet, well, I slightly pity you. There's a bit of that, isn't there? You know, this is where the connections are made. This is where things happen. And those who dwell out in the far reaches of the provinces, they're the kind of country bumpkins. And they're probably all a bit narrow-minded and racist and sexist and stupid. There's a bit of that, isn't there? I think that's quite interesting. In our cultural moment, we think of the socially mobile who can move, who can gentrify places. They're the ones who kind of nailed it. And we actually slightly humiliate the idea of just being settled in a home. Is it even possible for us today in our hyper-connected, hyper-globalized world to have a true sense of home anywhere? Well, our journey through Abraham's story in Genesis, it's touched on this theme a few times, hasn't it, if you've been with us, this idea of home, of a kind of sense of belonging and rootedness and a place. It was a big issue for Abraham. Do you remember God told him to move to the other side of the world, the other side of the known world? And he became a nomad, a resident foreigner in a strange land. But God had made promises. This land where I'm taking you, he said to Abraham, this will be the home of your descendants. It will belong to your offspring. This will be your people's home. And as we follow the story, do you remember last time, a couple of weeks ago, we had the hugely dramatic climax, didn't we, with Abraham and his son Isaac, the ultimate test of Abraham's faith and obedience. And so now we're getting towards the end of the story. This week, chapter 23, and next week, chapter 24. It's like, you know, when you're watching a film and you're into the last half hour and you can feel that kind of the tension's coming down, the threads are being brought together, everything's kind of being brought to a sense of closure. That's kind of what's happening here. So do you remember the two big promises that God's been making to Abraham? The promised offspring, who would bless the world, and the promised land, where God's people would dwell with God, enjoying his blessing. And so this story today, what Mary just read for us, it matters because it helps us see where our true home is. And it helps us to consider how to live now in the light of that. So let's work through the story together, okay? Genesis 23, then come with me to the city gate. That's where we are, okay? And we're going to join the growing crowd to witness this crucial moment. Verse 1, chapter 23, verse 1, and the great matriarch Sarah has died. Sarah lived to be 127 years old, a solid innings there. She died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. Factoid, this is the only woman in the Bible whose lifespan is recorded. She's a pretty big deal. She's the mother of God's people. And where does she die? At Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, the land of Canaan. This is the promised land, isn't it? This is where God told them to go, where they've been living as resident foreigners. God has promised it to their offspring. But, crisis moment, they've started dying. What's going to happen now? The tension, you see the tension's actually quite high again. It's like, oh no, hang on a minute. They're dying out. Are they going to just fizzle out of this land? What about all those promises? They don't possess the land yet. These are the issues kind of under the surface of the story. But first, Abraham does what any husband would do and mourns and weeps for his wife, his soulmate for a century. She's been at his side, hasn't she, of this extraordinary roller coaster of life following God through all the ups and downs, all their failures and triumphs, all their joys and sorrows. And to add to the sadness, is the fact that they're so far from home. They've left their homelands and their families decades ago. Abraham, the widower, is surrounded now by foreign people in a foreign land. It's a very poignant end of an era. But as is so often the case, in the midst of grief, there are jobs to be getting on with. And Abraham is strengthened, isn't he, to step up and take responsibility for a crucial issue at a critical moment. Because death, it gets you thinking, doesn't it? It inevitably gets you thinking about bigger things. It tends to get you thinking about what is really permanent, what really lasts. So he needs to bury Sarah. What's he going to do? The obvious thing would be to pack up his bags, move back to where they came from, back in chapter 12. That's their homeland. That's where their family is. Surely that's where she should be buried. Okay, it's been a great adventure, this whole following God thing, this living by faith, but she's actually died now. He's got to bury her somewhere. Surely it's the beginning of the end. Or could this somehow be the beginning of the future for God's people? He remembers God's promises. He remembers that God promised Abraham's descendants that they would inherit this land. He promised it in chapter 12, chapter 13, chapter 15, chapter 17. And Abraham believed God's promises. And so what does he do? Verse 3, he gets up. And verse 4, he grasps the nettle. The problem is, he's no legal rights in this land. He's just a resident foreigner and stranger, he says. And so the stage is set for the negotiations. Have you ever had to do this? If you ever, maybe you don't do it so much in the UK, do you? If you ever go on holiday somewhere abroad and the kind of culture is that you've got to do a bit of bartering when you buy something. It's incredibly awkward for us Brits, isn't it? Like, just dump me the price, I'll just buy it. Don't want to have to engage in conversation. But some cultures, that's just how you do it. When we lived in West Africa, this was always a source of hilarity when friends came to visit us. We'd take them to Serekan, the market. Quite an experience to see all the sights, smell all the smells, hear all the noises. And the number of times I would just cringe as British friends, they just couldn't possibly imagine bartering. I was like, you have to. That's how you buy things. So I'll just take the price they give me. No, completely ripping you off. You're missing out on half the fun as well. Well, this is what's going on here. This whole chapter, Genesis 23, is basically a bartering exchange. So, verse 4, here's what he's after. I'm a foreigner and stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site here so that I can bury my dead. He wants to buy a freehold, a permanent possession for future generations. Well, verse 5 and 6, they flatter him. They recognize his power and his social influence. He's become a big deal. You're a mighty prince. But amidst the flattery, they're keen actually to retain control, aren't they? Because they own the place. He doesn't. So they say, verse 6, listen to us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. Pick a tomb, any tomb. None of us will refuse. No need to pay, my friends. Well, the trouble is, he could go ahead and bury Sarah there, but then what? It would still belong to the Hittites. No, that won't do. So we enter round two of negotiations. Verse 7, the mighty prince humbles himself. Verse 7, he bowed down before the people of the land. He's got his eye on a particular property. He's favorited it on Rightmove. And verse 8, he said to them, if you are willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me. He said, listen to me, listen to me, listen to me. Listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf, so that he will sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him, and is at the end of his field. He won't miss it. Well, he never goes down that way. It's quite clever. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm sure he won't mind that bit. Just come on, that's the bit I want to buy. He's put his offer out there. Next, it goes to the solicitors, or the intermediaries. He asks the officials, yeah, go and speak to the seller, go and speak to the owner. But verse 10, surprisingly, Ephron, he doesn't bother with the intermediaries. He pipes up himself. The number of witnesses is increasing. Everyone's quite interested by what's going on. They're at the city gate, the center of civil affairs. And Ephron holds the default line. He toes the line of the city. Verse 11, no, my lord, listen to me. I give you the field and I give you the cave that's in it. A field? He wanted the cave and now he's throwing in a field as well. He's trying to, you see, it's a kind of game of one-upmanship. He's like, no, take the whole field. It's free. It won't cost you a penny. I'm trying to retain control of this land. Every interaction is laden with exaggerated politeness and deference. But really, it's all power plays, isn't it? The tension's rising. Who's going to win? What's going to happen? How long can this go back and forth? He doesn't want a gift. He wants to buy. Round three, verse 12. Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to everyone in the hearing, listen to me, if you will. I will pay the price of the fields. Accept it from me so that I can bury my dead there. I'll pay the price. It's a blank check. I don't know if you've ever watched Downton Abbey, but there are times where Lord Grantham has to bail out his wayward daughters and he gets out the checkbook. What'll it be? It's a blank check. He's saying, name your price. I will pay for this field. Well, now you can see the money bag spinning in Ephron's eyes. You're like, oh, okay. Must be pretty chuffed with how this is turning out now. And so he answers in verse 14. Ephron answered Abraham, listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. Now, that is an astronomical price. You need to look these things up, don't you, to conversion chart. But this is crazy, okay? This is astronomical. 1,000 years later, King David bought the temple site for 50 shekels. This guy's asking 400 shekels for a field. That's like nearly 4 kilograms of silver. It is absolutely astronomical. I mean, Ephron, he's surely won now, hasn't he? I mean, he's completely pricing him out of this negotiation. It's an unaffordable price tag. He'll never pay it, surely. And so he seeks to wrap it up. What's that between us? Accept the free gift. Bury your dead. Don't worry about the price. Aren't I generous? Efron and the Hittites think they've nailed it. They're going to maintain control and land ownership. You can imagine him patronizingly patting Abraham on the back. Nice try. Don't worry. But verse 16, Abraham calls his bluff. Verse 16, Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weight current among the merchants. He does it. It's a deal. He's going to pay. You can imagine him just giving a little nod to the servant. He goes round to the tents and loads up this donkey with sacks and sacks of silver. And everyone's thinking, oh my life, is he actually going to do it? 4 kilos of silver. And he buys the field. Even though it cost a ginormous sum, Abraham has secured possession of just a little bit of the promised land for future generations. You see, it's kind of a prophetic act. Despite their present minority status, they are there to stay. He's got eyes to see. He's got the eyes of faith. Burying Sarah in the land declares that he believed God would keep his promise to give this land to the offspring. He's even managed to pull it off whilst blessing his neighbors, the Hittites, with enormous wealth and maintaining goodwill and honor between everyone. It's an extraordinary success. The crazy price tag would go down in history, as it has done. It's a bit like, when Barcelona sold Neymar, how much for, Josh? Look at that, 200 mil. It goes down in history, unforgettable. It's an extraordinary success. And so as the story concludes, we're reminded why he favorited this particular place. Verse 17, so Ephron's field in Machpelah near Mamre. Ring any bells? Both the field and the cave in it and all the trees within the borders of the field was legally made over to Abraham. It was repeated in 2 verses 8 and 19. Afterwards, Abraham buried his wife Sarah, where? In the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre. Mamre. It's the place of the trees. Do you remember? It's where Abraham went to live, where he pitched his tents back in chapter 13, near the great trees of Mamre. Again, chapter 18, it's where the Lord appeared to him, where he shared a meal in his presence near the great trees of Mamre. And now he's ended up buying the spot of land with all the trees in it. What's with all the trees? Remember before? It's a sign, isn't it? It's a sign of Eden. It's reminiscent, reminding us of the place, the beautiful, life-giving, abundant place of God's blessing. You see, Abraham securing this plot of land, it represents a small but critical step towards bringing God's people to their future inheritance. So let's draw out 3 lessons for us from this story. And to help us, would you turn on to Hebrews 11 again? Find your bookmark. Because often the New Testament helps us to see what the Old Testament's really all about. And we're going to learn from seeing how this is recorded that faith sees beyond death. This is on your service sheets if you want to jot anything down. Faith sees beyond death. Now, some of us know this very well, don't we? But in the end, death will affect us all. It's just a matter of time. Often when we're in our 20s, we feel like we're going to live forever and we can't really imagine the reality of death. It's only a matter of time. And some of us have been confronted with the brutal reality of death much sooner than we would expect. Death is a time to think. It's a time to consider what lasts. And so for the Christian believer, death always hurts. But it doesn't have to be hopeless. Death is the most powerful time possible to remember that through faith in Jesus, we can know a true and certain hope beyond the grave. And death is a time to declare that hope. That's what Abraham was doing by burying Sarah in the promised land. So Hebrews 11, verse 13, all these people, he's just talking about Abraham and Sarah, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They didn't receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. Although they were foreigners, they were trusting in God's future promises. They were looking beyond the grave. And so years later, Abraham was buried in the same grave with Sarah. His son Isaac was buried in the same grave. His son Jacob. And the very end of Genesis, the very last words, is Joseph saying to his brothers, "When I die, take me back there and bury me with them." You see, they all add up to this picture of God's people looking beyond death to the eternal God who is our refuge. And he will keep on keeping his promises long after we're in the grave. Faith sees beyond death to our heavenly home. I don't know about you, in our first 5 years of marriage, we lived in five different homes. It can be a bit unsettling, can't it? Many of us know that, and we're desperate to just settle down somewhere. It's a very understandable feeling. But it's actually unrealistic. We'll never really be settled in this world. We'll never really be at home. And maybe that makes you a bit sad. You long for that experience of just being settled, maybe finding your dream home, choosing all the colours and furnishings. And so maybe you pity Sarah in this story. You know, poor old Sarah. She never really had a permanent home. But I think if we pity her, we've missed the point. Because her treasure wasn't in an earthly home, was it? It was in her heavenly home. Abraham's treasure wasn't in earthly possessions, but in his heavenly home. And so Hebrews 11, verse 15, if they had been thinking of the opportunity they had the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. They could have gone back there. But no, verse 16, instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Friends, I think this is where it cuts. This is where it challenges us, isn't it? It challenges our thinking, our desiring, our living. Because if the idea of no long-term earthly home makes you a little bit sad, it probably reveals that that's become an idol in your heart. You know, something that you desire, you love more than God and what he has promised. Abraham and Sarah's longing was for a better country, a heavenly one. The true citizenship of God's people is in heaven. And so to live by faith is to see the things promised and welcome them from a distance. That when Jesus returns, he will establish our perfect heavenly home forever with us. Then we will be at home. By our front door, we've got these words hanging up, written beautifully by Tansy's sister. We're not home till heaven opens. We've got a picture of that. We're not home till heaven opens. So important. That picture in our hallway, it actually led to me sharing a bit about Jesus with a Tesco delivery man a few days ago. We got it sort of cunningly positioned so that as the front door opens, he stands there with the crates, staring him right in the face. We're not home till heaven opens. We're waiting, aren't we? We're waiting by faith. And this is why it's such good news that Jesus was buried. Have you ever thought about that? You know, once a month we say the Apostles' Creed. We say these kind of huge, central, historic truths of the Christian faith from over the millennia. And we say these words, he was crucified, died, and was buried. Why does it matter that he was buried? I mean, couldn't he just, you know, die for our sins and then ping, raise again? I think theologically he probably could have done. And, you know, his death in our place would still do what it was meant to do. But no, he was buried. He chose to identify with our experience of being buried, laid in the grave, and waiting for our resurrection. He had to wait for God the Father to raise him from the dead. And so we will share in that same experience, dying and being buried, to wait for God the Father to raise us from the dead. Do you realize that that's what's going to happen? We'll be laid in the grave. And when Jesus returns to judge the world, to gather his beloved people to himself, he will raise Sarah and Abraham and all who were trusting in him before Jesus came, all who were waiting from afar. He'll raise all who've put their trust in Jesus since he came, including you and me. Our decomposed bodies, our disintegrated skeletons. He can do it. He's the creator. We'll be raised and recreated into new, glorious, incorruptible bodies. And we will be at home. Safe, secure, at peace, forever. With our God and Saviour. So, fix your eyes on Jesus. That's where Hebrews lands. After chapter 11, recounting all these stories of people living by faith, like Abraham and Sarah, longing for a better country, a heavenly home. After mentioning them all, look down with me at Hebrews 12. This is the big takeaway lesson. Hebrews 12, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. Throw off any sin that's entangling you. Run with perseverance, fixing your eyes on Jesus. When we forget our heavenly home, sin entangles us. Essentially, it's the sin of worldliness, isn't it? Making this world our home. I mean, remember Abraham was repeatedly offered that tomb for free. You might think, dude, just take it. Like, why spend all those sacks of silver? Just take the free gift. But no, he could sit loose to his material possessions. 4 kilos of silver. Because he wasn't living for this world. He was living for his heavenly home. What was far more valuable to him was living in line with the fulfillment of God's promises. He knew he was a foreigner and stranger. He'd never be at home here. So he didn't cling to the things of this world. He was just passing through. He had his sights set on something beyond, something eternal, something heavenly. He saw, Hebrews says, he saw the things promised from a distance. And so we too can see Jesus, fix our eyes on Jesus, who brings everything God promises. Friends, this world is not our home. It never will be. What matters is our heavenly home. What matters for everyone around us is getting to that heavenly home. And what gets people there is the gospel of Jesus. As some of us heard last week at Revive, heaven is very happy. Hell is very horrible. Eternity is a very long time. The more that sinks in, and it takes time. We're stubborn and slow to learn, aren't we? But the more that sinks in, the more radically and wholeheartedly we will use whatever we have in this world to further the gospel and get people to heaven, to their true home. So do you see, the implication of this isn't go and become Amish and just like give all your stuff away. Abraham and Sarah, they were wealthy. The issue is, what are you using your wealth for? What are you using your life for? Are you using it to make yourself temporarily comfortable in this world? Or to make others eternally comfortable in heaven? Throw off the worldliness that so easily entangles. You can run the marathon of faith with your eyes fixed on Jesus. It will transform everything, won't it? I mean, it'll transform this week, how we talk about politics and the election. It matters. But what matters far more to us is the kingdom of heaven and King Jesus, who's never up for re-election. It will transform our approach to our possessions. The Hittites at the city gate, they must have thought Abraham was mad, crazy, using all his money in such a reckless way. And living by faith will look mad. It'll look crazy and reckless to the world around us. Contributing generously, sacrificially to buying a staff flat for ministry in Balham, as we've talked about recently. That'll look crazy and reckless to the world. Pouring energy and prayers and finance into planting a church. It'll look mad. It'll look reckless and crazy to the world. Turning down a promotion or a job that would mean you can't love your spouse or your children or your church. That'll look mad, crazy and reckless to the world. But we know, don't we? Because Jesus rose from the dead, that we're only passing through. We're foreigners and strangers. And so biblical wisdom will actually put the kingdom of heaven at the top of the list. That alone is certain. And finally, this will transform our attitude to suffering. And Hebrews 12 says, we fix our eyes on Jesus as we run with perseverance so that we don't grow weary. 2 Corinthians 4 exhorts us to fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen, so that we don't lose heart, though outwardly we're wasting away. I'll be very surprised if your week this week doesn't involve hardship and suffering. That's when you need to go home in your heart, in your head. Go home. Let your heart take you home to Jesus. Fix your eyes on Jesus. He endured suffering and entered the joy of his heavenly home so that we can join him. We're not home till heaven opens. Let's go home.